Let me add my word of welcome, and glad that you're here inside where it's nice and dry, and a very fitting morning to be talking about the flood story of Genesis 6, the first rain we've had in some weeks. It's still too early for my taste, but God did not consult with me in that decision, so we just have to put up with what we get, and actually be thankful for it, of course. I'm trying an experiment today with a handout in your bulletin, so follow along with that if you like, and if you are not a note taker, that's fine too. If you are 21 years or younger, you've never known a world without seatbelt laws. And in a way, I feel sorry for you. When I was a kid, I guess we had seat belts, but, you know, I really don't remember. Nobody used them. I do know that. And since we never had an accident where a seat belt would have saved us from injury, I can say that I'm glad I grew up in a world without seat belt laws, because I think I would have missed out on a lot of fun. I think it would have been very dreary on those long trips, having to sit in one spot, rooted there, and buckled in. Even though I always do that now and always make sure that everybody in the car that I'm driving is buckled in. Of course, please don't mistake me, but I'm telling you this story because it has everything to do with not wearing seatbelts, not having laws that required seatbelts. One of my favorite memories as a kid is traveling as a family in our car on a kind of a long trip at one that involved nightfall. Traveling in our 1959 Ford station wagon. Let's see. Are we ready to go here, Jim?
Yes.
Let's see. This just doesn't have an on switch, does it?
No.
But it's not on. It's not. The laser light isn't working either. Oh, now it's on. Okay. That's not our 1959 Ford station wagon, but so you can get an idea of what I'm talking about. We'd be traveling as a family, and after it got dark, my brother and my sister and me would climb over the back seat into the way back, as we called it, where we would lie down and go to sleep as the car went on through the night. And it seemed like magic to me, this experience. Sort of an other world that I was in. I think it had to do with the fact that it was kind of like it was the security, almost as if we were at home in our own bed, but we weren't at home in our bed. We were barreling down the highway through the dark. And it was just cool to fall asleep in that. And if it was raining, it was even better. In fact, the very best if there was a thunderstorm happening. There was that sense of security for me. I felt safe. I knew everything was going to be all right because my dad was there. My dad was at the wheel, and I didn't have anything to worry about. I could just lie down and go to sleep with the sound and the feel of the car and the rain on the car, and it was just a perfect kind of childhood experience in a way. Now, again, I'm not recommending that you do that with your children or your grandchildren at all. I'm relating that story because I believe that that memory is an effective illustration of the central truths of the flood story. And that is that God safely carries us through the storms of life. In your most vulnerable time, in the time when you feel most threatened and most tempted to be afraid, you need to remember that God is in control and He is carrying you. He is protecting you. His faithful love is all around you. You may be anxious today. You may be feeling vulnerable. You may have issues of health. You may be grieving. You may have good reason to worry. You may be actually in pain. You may have concerns about money. You may be unemployed and can't find a job. You may have issues in your family. You may have school issues where you don't know how you're going to handle stuff that's happening at school or at work. You may have problems in your marriage. To be human is to live through storms. And I'm here to tell you that God has His hand of protection on you in those storms of life, and He calls you to trust Him, and I really believe that's what we read in the flood account. Now, our text today is Genesis, from Genesis chapter 6, verse 9, all the way through chapter 9, verse 29. That's 109 verses. It's more than we can completely cover. But I do want to touch on most of it, and I will dwell on the most important parts. But here's one way to see the structure of this story. It begins with man's corruption of the earth through sin, then God's destruction of the earth through water, God's deliverance of life through the ark, his decree of forbearance towards all, towards the earth, his pledge toward all living creatures, and it ends on a very sad note, on man's failure and shame. Everybody knows the story, of course, but we all love to hear it. First, we meet the human characters, beginning with Noah. Genesis 6, verse 9, this is the account of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, of course, we actually met Noah already at the end of chapter 5. But here we are told something more about his character. The Bible says that he is righteous and devout. And this is in particular contrast to everything that's going on around him. In fact, it says that Noah walked with God. He walked with God. There's only two people that the Bible says that about. One is Enoch, that we just read in chapter 5. The other one is Noah. And he has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And by the way, next Sunday we'll be talking about that, and I would encourage you this week to find some time to read through Genesis chapter 10 and 11 in preparation for what we're going to talk about next Sunday. Now, we also meet the bad guys. Actually, we don't meet them, but we do hear about their character, and it's not very good. Look at verse 11. Now, the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I'm surely going to destroy both them and the earth. Now, it's very evident that the author is emphasizing the ugliness of society here. Did you see how many times the word corrupt is used? Corrupt in God's sight, filled with violence. God saw the earth, behold, it was corrupt. All flesh had corrupted their way on earth. The earth is filled with violence through the influence of humans. And if we were to jump back up to verse 5 that we read a few weeks ago, it says, the Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. Now, why is it important and why is this emphasized? Here's one. If we don't see God's view of the world and how messed up and how corrupted the world was and how depraved, the human depravity that's pictured there, if we don't get that, we're not going to understand the story of the flood and how God could do what he did and why. But we have a problem. In America, in 2011, it isn't fashionable to talk about sin. It's seen as rude and offensive and judgmental. And so we have this difficulty in our culture. And we do need to be careful that we're not sounding like somehow that we're better than others, that only others are sinners and we're not, that we're above sin. Years ago, you may remember the part of the country where we lived, at least, there was a popular bumper sticker that tried to address this issue. It said, Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven. Do you remember that? But I haven't seen that bumper sticker in a long time, and I have an idea that today, even that would come across as pious. It's like, oh, okay, so you Christians are forgiven, but the rest of us have to be condemned. So that's kind of what we're up against here today, this attitude that, you know, you just can't talk about sin. So how can we faithfully speak of what God is seeing in the world here without sounding hypocritical? Well, here's one way. See, God isn't the only one who is offended by sin. Humans are offended by sin too. Of course, we're never offended by our own sin. In fact, maybe we're really not that much of a sinner, but those guys out there, all those people out there, their sin offends us. And we can see that evil happening around us. For example, just like these headlines that all came from this week. A couple accused of stealing millions intended for preschoolers' meals. A mom who gambles away donations to fight her son's cancer. An 8-year-old girl arrested for punching a vice principal. 24 men rescued from slavery in London. Last week they had been in slavery. A dead boy lived in a squalid home with more than 100 animals. Every one of those headlines came from just this last week. Let that sink in for a minute. That ugliness sink in, and you start to get a view of what sin looks like to God. Of God's perspective in Genesis 6. One writer has said, put it like this, sin has reached its critical mass. Okay? We read in James, in the book of James, way back in the New Testament, that sin, when it has conceived, brings forth death. And that's what's happening here in Genesis 6. Sin is fully grown, and it's about to bring forth death. You know, here's something interesting. Do you see the word corrupt in verse 11? Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight. In verse 12, God saw how corrupt the earth had become. And look in verse 13. God says, I'm going to destroy both them and the earth. That's the same word in the Hebrew, corrupt and destroy. Man corrupts, God destroys. Man starts the job, God is going to finish the job. The earth was already ruined. Another writer said what God decided to destroy had already been self-destroyed. So God inaugurates his plan by giving Noah instructions about the ark. First, how to build it. Look at verse 14. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in it and coat it with pitch inside and out. This is how you are to build it. The ark is to be 450 feet long, 75 feet wide and 45 feet high. Make a door, make a roof for it, and finish the ark to within 18 inches of the top. Put a door in the side of the ark and make lower, middle, and upper decks. So with very simple words, make yourself an ark out of gopher wood. Seven simple words, Noah has a big job to do, and it's going to take him a long time. Maybe 100 years. You will remember maybe when we were talking about the early part of chapter 6, and it says that God says man's days will be 120 years, and we're not sure, does that mean man is going to live to be 120 years after this, or does it mean in 120 years I'm going to send the flood? And I kind of leaned towards that, but when I was studying for this, I realized, no, that can't be, because Noah is 500 at the end of chapter 5. And when the flood starts, he's 600. So there's not 120 years, there's 100 years. We don't know how long this takes, but it was a big job. You can see from the dimensions. It's a football, and it's 1.5 times a football field in length, 450 feet. And of course, he didn't have, you know, the wonderful power tools that we have today. 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. Put some rooms in it, put a roof on it, put a door on it. I found this artist's depiction of what the ark may have looked like. We can't really know for sure because we don't have that level of detail. You may be aware that some people, even today, some people have used these instructions to build a life-size replica of the ark. It gives you some idea. And, you know, you can find anything on the internet today. I actually found a picture of Noah with his completed ark in the background. Just kidding. So then God gives instructions about how to load the ark. Look in verse 17. I'm going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens, every creature that has the breath of life in it. I said to Bart that Psalm 150 is very appropriate. Let everything that has breath praise the Lord, because God continues to give us the breath of life. Everything on earth will perish, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you will enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. You are to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you, two of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal and of every kind of creature that moves along the ground will come to you to be kept alive. You are to take every kind of food that is to be eaten and store it away as food for you and for them. Noah did everything just as God commanded him. Let's see, let's go down through verse 6. The Lord then said to Noah, "Go into the ark, you and your whole family, because I have found you righteous in this generation. Take with you seven of every kind of clean animal, a male and its mate, and two of every kind of unclean animal, a male and its mate, and also seven of every kind of bird, male and female, to keep their various kinds alive throughout the earth. 7 days from now, I will send rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and I will wipe from the face of the earth every living creature I have made." And Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood came on the earth. Up to now, the warnings have been very general, but now everything becomes brutally clear. Now Noah understands why the big boat. Because God is going to send a flood. You know, probably every one of us has heard this story for so long that it's, and for so many years since we were really young, that it's hard to appreciate the impact of these words the first time they were said. We need to try to read the Bible as if we were reading it for the first time and sense, what could this have felt like to Noah? How does a guy handle what he's just been told like this? But here's the interesting thing. We are told nothing at all about Noah's response to this. We have no record of what he had anything to say. And that's very amazing. And I ask myself, what does that mean? Because I do believe it means something. But just hold on, stand by, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But notice something that God says near the beginning of these instructions. In verse 18, "I will establish my covenant with you." Well, a covenant, that's an agreement. God is committing himself to something. The ark is God's vehicle for preserving the lives of a few while he destroys the lives of many. He is promising to save Noah and his family while the rest of creation is utterly devastated. And God says you are to bring two of all living creatures, male and female, with you, and they'll need to eat, so get everything ready. And God's command is very simple. Noah's obedience is very simple. In verse 22, Noah did everything just as God commanded him. Again, these 10 words capture a long, long time, maybe decades. But we don't have any further details about that in contrast to the many details that we have about what's about to happen. In chapter 7, verse 1, finally God says, "Go into the ark, you and your whole family." And he gives some further instruction about the animals. Of every kind of clean animal, the ones that can be eaten, take seven. All the others, take two. Noah does not have to get on a horse and go round all of these up. Did you notice it says in chapter 6, verse 20, "They will come to you to be kept alive." And again in chapter 7, verse 9, the animals came to Noah to enter the ark. The rain is going to last 40 days. Sounds like Oregon. Especially for people like us who come from sunny Nebraska. Now, this could mean a literal 40 days, but 40 days is a Hebrew figure of speech for a long time. So again, we're not perfectly sure about that. And so the storm begins. Look at verse 10. "After 7 days, the flood waters came on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened, and rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Now, the atmosphere could not possibly hold enough water to flood the earth, but the water also comes from below. Did you see that? The fountains of the great deep burst forth. And the rest of chapter 7 speaks again about the animals on the ark. It describes briefly the destruction of the world by water and the salvation of the company on the ark. Now, let's talk a little bit about the science. Some people say this could not possibly have been a global flood. It had to be a local or regional flood because, as they would say, the logistics of flooding the entire world over all the mountains, they're just ridiculous. But look at chapter 7, verse 19. It's talking about the waters. They rose greatly on the earth, and all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of more than 20 feet. It says twice, the mountains, all the mountains under heaven. So it seems to leave no room for anything, to my simple way of thinking, but a global flood. So how much water does it take to bury Mount Everest by 20 feet? A lot of water. Now, I have a friend in Calgary, his name is Larry Sheldon, who is a geologist and an amateur creation scientist. But because he's a geologist and he's interested in creation science, I asked him about this, and this is what he sent me. I think it's helpful for you to see his thinking about this. As for the mountains being covered and the amount of water, we know geologically that the majority of the mountains are relatively young, including the Rockies and the Himalayas. Even their shape shows that. Sharp peaks and steep valleys indicate immaturity. Older mountains, like the Canadian Shield, tend to be beveled off. Some of the more intermediate ones, such as the Appalachians, show signs of being eroded down from their original heights. Who is to say that these younger mountains predate the flood? So how high were the mountains that had to be covered? Not 15,000 feet or 29,000 feet. Also, geological evidence says that prior to these mountain building times, there was only one supercontinent and therefore one sea. That fits Genesis 1. That's a very interesting thing to me. Very interesting. The atmosphere, as I said, could not hold enough rain, but the original creation had waters above and waters below. It also says that the fountains of the deep were broken open, which would have released the water from below. We are talking catastrophic fluid movements that would be far in excess of any hurricane or tsunami that we have seen. Now, the section of the story that we're reading now is about the waters. And look at chapter 7, verse 17. For 40 days, the flood kept coming on the earth, and as the waters increased, they lifted the ark high above the earth. The waters rose and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. They rose greatly on the earth, and all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of more than 20 feet. You see the repetition there? The waters kept coming. They increased. They rose and increased greatly. They rose greatly on the earth. The waters rose and covered the mountains. It's about the waters, and the word rose is a military word for succeeding in battle. The writer is saying, you know what? The waters won. They conquered. They covered up the entire mountain, the entire earth, over the tops of all the mountains. And all the time, the company in the ark is kept safe. And then we come to the turning point, where we read in chapter 8, verse 1, but God remembered Noah. By the way, years ago, I came across a little book at a friend's house, and it was called But God. And it was a book about all of the verses in the Bible that begin with those two words. And it was an amazing study to see, you know, things are going along, and it's like there's no hope. But God. One of my favorite is, my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Here, but God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark. And he sent a wind over the earth, and the waters receded. Now the springs of the deep and the floodgates of the heavens had been closed, and the rain had stopped falling from the sky. The water receded steadily from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the water had gone down. And on the 17th day of the seventh month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. The waters continued to recede until the 10th month. And on the first day of the 10th month, the tops of the mountains became visible. So now the waters begin to retreat. The ark finally settles on a mountain, not a mountain named Ararat, but a mountain in the region of Ararat. But the story is far from over. In fact, Noah and his company are less than halfway through the time they're going to be in the ark. We can see this because the narrator is very careful to give us dates through the story. Chapter 7, verse 11, the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, that's when it all started, okay? Verse 24 says, there isn't any verse, oh, there we go. The waters flooded the earth for 150 days. In chapter 8, it talks about the end of the 150 days. And verse 4, the 17th day of the seventh month, the ark came to rest. I won't trace it all the way through, but here's what the schedule looks like. Let's say it's the second year of Noah's life. Let's say Noah happened to be born on January 1. Of course, it wasn't January, February, March, but just for the sake of illustration, okay, the rain begins on the 17th of February. The rain ends on the 27th of March. So 40 days have elapsed. Now, the rain has stopped. We've got to go through April. We've got to go through May. We've got to go through June. Finally, on the 17th of July, the ark bumps and rests, and we're done floating on the top of the water. And we've been in there 150 days. Well, we've got to go through August. We've got to go through September. On the 1st of October, the mountaintops can be seen. We've been in the boat 223 days. We've got to go through November. We've got to go through December. And on the 1st of January, it says, the waters had dried up. And finally, on the 27th of February, we can get out of this boat. We've been in that boat 375 days. 1 year and 10 days. And I think, wow, they must have been grateful to get back on dry land. This group has lived through the most epic disaster story in history. We love our disaster stories, don't we? You know, volcanoes and earthquakes and floods. This one is the archetype. This one is the original, never to be exceeded or repeated. That's what God is about to decide. Noah built an altar, verse 20. Noah came out together, Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. And then the story comes to a very intriguing part that describes God's acts after the flood. First, his decision in verse 21, never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. And then his decree in verse 22, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. We're going to come back to this in a moment. Let's just quickly cover what happens in the last part of the story. Mention it. We can't cover it. God has some further instruction for Noah in the first seven verses of chapter 9, including he's going to lift the restriction of the vegetarian diet that Adam had been given. And I'm so glad because I like to eat meat. He forbids eating meat with the blood. Here we go. What's going on here? I'm missing a slide. I thought I had a slide in there. Okay, I'll just read these to you. He institutes capital punishment, and he renews the creation mandate that Adam originally was given to be fruitful and multiply. In fact, that bookends this section. He says it in verse 1, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. And he says it again in verse 7, as for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. There's so much we could say about that, but we just can't cover everything in this text. Then we come to the very famous promise of the rainbow. And God doesn't just promise not to destroy the earth by water. He sort of binds himself to a contract. Let's look at verse 8. Then God said to Noah and his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, all the wild animals, and all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth, I will establish my covenant with you. Never again will life be cut off by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I'm making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth. Did you notice some repetition there? Anybody count the number of times as I was going through there, how many times the word covenant is used? Well, I did, and when I came to 6, I thought, oh, one more, and it would be the number of perfection. And there it showed up. 7 times God makes reference to covenant. This is the first time in the Bible that we read many, many occasions of the use of this word covenant. In fact, this is the beginning of so much that we have in our society comes from this idea of covenant. God is saying, you can trust me. You can depend on me. I'm good to my word. And because we are made in his image, we can be the same way. And all that, so much that we have in this society, the rule of law, the idea of a constitution, a system of courts to uphold justice, contracts, agreements of any kind of binding kind of agreements, banking systems, all of that starts right here with the concept of covenant that we can be depended on is grounded in the fact that God is dependable. He is a covenant-keeping God. He will be true to his word. And he puts a symbol in the sky to say, there it is, you can see that and you know that you can count on me. Now the story ends on a pathetic note. Man's failure when Noah gets drunk and brings shame on himself, lying naked in his tent. And maybe something more than just nakedness happened. Whatever it was, it disgraces Noah. The blameless, righteous man who walks with God is disgraced. And remember in chapter 8, verse 21, God says every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. It didn't take long for that to come true. Here's Noah in disgrace. And finally, at the very end, the author picks up the genealogy that we last saw in chapter 5. If you were here when we preached earlier, maybe you remember there's a genealogy running all through this ancient section of Genesis. And that's where it ends. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Altogether, Noah lived 950 years, and then he died. That's the story, in a very fast pace. But what does it mean? Why do we have this story in the Bible? What was the author doing with the story, and what does it mean to you and me today? Let's just spend a few minutes trying to answer these questions. The Genesis flood is the original cataclysm. That's a word that means violent upheaval. It brought global death and destruction. It reshaped the planet. It created mountains. It's hard to grasp the sheer power of what happened in the flood, of what God did in the flood. And it's easy to understand why cultures all over the world would have their flood stories, because they do. Many, many cultures around the world, I don't know if every culture, but many cultures have their flood stories. And I think that has everything to do with what Moses is doing. Moses wrote Genesis. Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. He wrote them to the children of Israel. They had escaped from Egypt. They were in the wilderness. They were going to Canaan. They had come out of one pagan culture in Egypt. They were on their way to another pagan culture in Canaan. Both of these pagan cultures had their own gods, and the worship of these gods was a competition with the worship of Jehovah, and they both had their stories about what happened in the flood. And I believe what Moses is doing here is countering their stories with the truth of whose power was really at work in the flood. You see, the pagan myths had multiple gods who were jealous of each other, who were petty, who had limited power and authority, and they flooded the world because they got mad. In fact, one account, just get how directly opposite they are. God keeps saying to man, multiply, fill the earth. I want lots of people. One of these accounts said that the flood was sent, quote, to destroy man who was breeding too fast and making too much noise. Remember that the next time you hear somebody talking about the population problem. Where does that come from? In another version, one human escapes the flood because one of the gods tipped him off, which made the other gods mad. And then the flood gets out of control. And these gods get frightened and they cower like dogs. See, there's a lot more that could be said about this, but maybe you start to get the point. The biblical story contrasts the truth with what these pagan nations believe. And every one of these contrasts is a testimony to God, to His greatness, His majesty, His power, His glory, and to His goodness and love. Here's why I say that. Since as long as I can remember, I've heard the story of Noah and the flood. How many else have heard that story? You know, there's something wrong with saying it like that. Noah and the flood? Yes, it was Noah that built the ark, as God commanded him. It was Noah and his family that are saved. Noah was righteous and blameless, but you know what? The hero isn't Noah. Noah is not the central character of this story. Remember earlier I said we don't hear anything from Noah? We don't have a single quote of Noah in this whole story. And remember I said, that's kind of curious. What can that mean? I said, stand by. Here's what it means. It's not about Noah. Noah is a supporting player. This story is about God. And I ask you, what do we learn about God in this story? Well, we've seen about His holiness. He can't tolerate sin. We certainly have seen His power. Who else can flood the earth and never lose control? But here's another thing we learn about God. He's in charge. The Bible uses the word sovereign. He's in charge. It would be possible to have a lot of power but not be in charge. But He has all the power and He is in charge. And because He is, we can trust Him in the storms of life. I want to go back to, I think, the intriguing part of this story at the end of chapter 8. Verses 21 and 22. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in His heart, never again will I curse the ground because of man. Even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will never cease. Who is He talking to? He's talking to Himself. It says, God said in His heart. We are reading the thoughts of God. He is self-reflecting here. This isn't a promise. The promise comes later. This is a simple decision on his own, and without consulting anyone, God decides no more of that. On his own and for his own sake, God simply decides, never again will I curse the ground. Never again will I destroy all living creatures. You know what? God does whatever he wants because he's in charge. He is sovereign. He decides. I mentioned earlier that's the decision, and verse 22 is the decree. And I didn't explain then because I wanted to wait till this moment. What's the difference? The decision is what is private. The decree is public. You see, the decision is, in his mind, this is what he's deciding. But because of the decree, you see, we're the ones who live with seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night. Those are the things that we can see that were the result of God's decision. That's why I call it a decree. God smells the pleasing aroma, and he decrees this. He acts on his own behalf. He gets pleasure from his creation. He made it for himself. Remember, I've talked a little bit about what we call the creator-creature distinction. God is God and you are not. Because he is, he can do this, you see. And he's not acting improperly as you and I would be if we tried, as we sometimes do, to make ourselves the center of the universe. You see, it's precisely because we are not God that it's wrong for us to do that. It's precisely because he is God that it's all together in perfect virtue that he's acting when he does this. But he's also acting in mercy and grace and perfect love. You see, the terrible extinguishing of all life by water, it will never happen again because God so decides. All of the fundamental components of life, cold and heat, seed time and harvest, summer and winter, day and night, we have all of those things and they will continue as long as the earth endures because God said so. And that's all it takes is for him to say that. And nobody else could do that. Nobody else has the power. Only one person, only one being can simply decide and it will be so. And he isn't even talking. He's just thinking. He doesn't have anything to prove. He's in charge. The Bible says God is sovereign. God's sovereignty and his power go together. Jeremiah said, "Ah, sovereign Lord, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. Nothing is too hard for you." The flood is his power in action, and what he does here is his power in restraint. The gods cower, but Jehovah acts with sovereign power. And what does he do with that sovereign power? He loves and cares for his own. He saves Noah and company, and he still saves today. He safely carries his own through every storm. You can trust him for that. You must trust him for that. He is faithful, even when you are not. You see, it's because he is worthy of your trust because of who he is. And you can trust him because of who he is, not because of your own merit. That's why we trust God. One more thing. Look very carefully one more time. He says this in verse 21. "Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood." Now, if you read that once, you don't think about it, but this is a very, very curious thing, because why did God send the flood? Because of the sinfulness of man. So he doesn't say what you would expect. You would expect him to say, "Okay, I'm not going to curse the ground because of man, because now man has learned his lesson. I'm not going to again curse the ground because of man, because now the sin is gone. I'm not going to curse the ground because the sin has been paid for." No. Man's wickedness is not gone. On the contrary, He says every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. Here we are after the flood, and it's still the testimony of God that man is sinful. Man is sinful, and yet the ground will not be made to pay for the sin of man. The ground will not be made to pay for man's sin. So, what will happen to man's sin? Oh, maybe God is just going to be more flexible. He's going to be more tolerant. He's not going to be so judgmental. No. God will remain the standard of righteousness and justice in the universe, just as you want him to, because nobody wants to live in a world, in a universe, without standards. That's not the answer. That's not what happens here. When God says that the ground will not be made to pay for man's sin, it's because he has another plan. One that he instituted from before the foundation of the world, because another will pay for the sin of man. Another death will happen that will pay the full price of the sin of man. Because one will go to the cross and in his own perfect body and soul and spirit will offer himself to God in your place. And because that happened, we can have life. And because that happened, we can trust God in every storm of life. He is faithful.